So good morning, everyone. Those of you live in the hall and those of you live at home. Raylan, how many people are online with us this morning? 87. So we're about 35 or so in the hall. So we are a little community together, practicing together this morning, supporting ourselves. So this is the first Dharma talk of the new year. Even though outwardly, it doesn't seem like much has changed as we went from 21 to 22, a lot of the same issues, problems that were there a week ago, a little more than a week ago, yeah, are still here. So that is because in the unfolding of causes and conditions, there's always a continuity. But the one thing that we have some ability to change incrementally or dramatically is ourselves. We don't have to wait. We don't have to wait for anything to happen outside ourselves to begin the process of healing and transformation within. And this is the great gift that has been given us by this ancient tradition, that the technology of how to go about that transformation is readily available, doable, practical, applicable, etc. But as we often stress, there has to be within each of us that aspiration, that desire to want to change. And we have to be the drivers of that. Each of us have to be the drivers. So for those of you who were involved in our beginning a new ceremony on New Year's Day, or those of you who listen to us, we stress that. And so since this is the first Dharma talk of the new year, I think it's important that we check in with ourselves. So it was New Year. Today is the what? 8th or 9th? 9th. So nine days ago, we sat in this hall. Many of you were at home, and we wrote down what our aspirations, intentions, commitments were for the new year. So please, and of course, many of you might have done that on your own in other formats. So anyhow, please just close your eyes a second and see if you can remember 9 days ago, what you wrote down, what you took home with you. What shifts or changes did you want to make in your life, your relationships, your minds, the actions of your body, speech, and mind? Please recall. And take a moment to assess. How have I been doing on the implementation side of setting an intention, making a vow, having a commitment? This is most important. Have I been true to myself? Have I remembered? Was I mindful? Have I given attention to this? central part of my life, or not. The ability to make an objective assessment of ourselves, to be self-aware without judgment, without guilt or shame, you know, is very much part of our practice. We have to learn to just to be objective. Kind of third person with ourselves. Many of us bring these skills to our work or other aspects of our life, but we seem to have a great inability to do it within ourselves, or let's just stick with ourselves for now. So please take an assessment of how you've been doing, if doing at all. And then based on that, in this moment, we can begin anew. Each of us have the winds. Buddhism, we say the winds of a karma blowing through us. Our actions of our body, our actions of our speech, our actions of our mind are all conditioned by the past, the way we've been. And yet, if there is self-awareness, if there is mindfulness, there is a growing strength in aspiration. One can move this ship that we are all navigating with in the direction we want. So please take a moment within each of us to, if you've been on track, then stay on track. But if you got off track, if you forgot, if you forget, just renew. Remember. And maybe, you know, if you kind of messed up along the way in the last 9 days, that's okay. The big deal is not that we mess up. The big deal is if we don't stop and look deeply into why we messed up, so we don't keep doing it. It's okay to trip, it's okay to fall. But if we never stop to look to see what I'm tripping and falling over and just keep doing it, then there's no learning, there's no change. We all have that capability if we stop, pause, look deeply. This is mindfulness. Mindful of our causes and conditions. Mindful, aware that there is another way. But for many of us, it's so hard for us to take the steering wheel of our life. We've surrendered it to so many other things, so many other forces. This practice is very empowering. It encourages us to sit in the driver's seat of our life, to have our two hands on our steering wheel, which means the actions of our body, speech, and mind, to know where we want to go, stay on the road, stronger our determination to get where we want to go, the better chance that we'll stay on the road. So again, please take a moment to reflect. No matter what our situation in life, it is important that we all see a way forward. If all we see are obstacles and barriers and challenges, sort of sabotage ourselves before we even begin. Since the way forward primarily has to do with our own inner life, it does can imply making some shifts in the way we live our life or what we do, but the most important thing is the within piece. We really have a sense of our lives and how we want to lead our lives, the way we want to be in our life, the way we want to relate to people. The kind of mind we wake up with and the kind of mind we have with us during the day and the kind of mind we go to sleep with. This is why we are here. So we are fortunate in our community that we have a community. We're not alone. We have a path, we have teachings, we have a community, we have an institution, the Florida Community of Mindfulness. So we have things like today and morning meditations and evening meditations, and we have classes and workshops and retreats and intensives, all to what? To support and nourish our desire to change, to be a better person, to be a happier person, a wiser person, more compassionate person, less stressed person. Right, all those things, right? This is why we are here. Because to do that alone is difficult. To do that without support is difficult, daunting. But with the support of a community, with the support of other practitioners, and with, you know, lots of opportunities at all different stages for us to tap into, healing and transformation is much more doable. You know, to have the support of people, for those who are newer, to have the support, the examples of people who've been on this a while and can speak about their own healing and transformation. So you know this is not made up or a fraudulent endeavor. The fruits are available. So that's all here. In the coming weeks, we have what? We have a workshop Betsy's giving next Saturday on aspiration intention, really the nuts and bolts of the importance of it and the nuts and bolts of having doing it. So those are people who are going, well, I'm not doing too well so far this year. There's an opportunity. We have two intensives starting up at the Dharma and Wisdom level and at the Mindful Living. Our intensives are great opportunities for people to kind of, in the context of their life, work, family, to get the support and the structure they need. Many of us don't have a lot of we don't have a lot of self-discipline. So the whole purpose behind intensives is to kind of give a structure to support us. You'll be seeing that, you know, all kinds of activities. There's a book club, and I chose the book for the club, At Home in the World. I don't know how many of you know this, but they're all just short stories. I mean, they're, you know, a page, two page, and they're all from the life. They're like Thich Nhat Hanh's life, from childhood through his monastic career, all the way through troubles in Vietnam and exile and, you know, establishing Plum Village and, you know, I really enjoy it. And again, they're not stories, they're teaching stories. There's a wonderful quote from him in the front of the book. It says, teaching is not done by talking alone. It is done by how you live your life. My life is my teaching. My life is my message. Beautiful. So he's willing, you know, and these are not just, stories from his life. These are teaching stories. You know, he's, in all of them, we're learning something. But as he says, his teaching is the way he lives his life. And so by sharing the way he's lived his life, we learn how to make perhaps better to live our own life. So that's another something that you could join, and when is it? It's January 31st through February. So I want to talk today about engaged Buddhism. It's not as if we never talk about engaged Buddhism, but I still think that even though there's a lot of talk about engaged Buddhism and, Thich Nhat Hanh, the father of engaged Buddhism, and for those who are just familiar somewhat with the Buddhist world, I mean, that's all you hear, you know, engaged Buddhism, engaged Buddhism, engaged Buddhism. And he's the one who really developed the idea. But I think it's been hijacked a little bit away from really what he meant meant. So I want to share that today. And then to look to see what that really means for each of us and for a community to practice engaged Buddhism. And actually Angie and I were there in Hanoi in 2008, where he gave a talk, sort of his own personal talk about engaged Buddhism, because his own personal story is not that well known. So I did find that somebody transcribed it, and it was published a number of years ago in the magazine of the Thich Nhat Hanh communities called The Mindfulness Bell. It's 1954, he's a young monk, and he said there was great confusion among the people of Vietnam, especially the young people. He says North Vietnam was inspired by Marxism, right? And in South Vietnam, the president was a Catholic who had his own philosophy that was called personalism. I think I knew about that a while ago. But basically something was happening which was very new, right? And it really took people like Thich Nhat Hanh, it kind of blew them away, because human history, and Southeast Asia, Vietnam, and all that, it's not as if they hadn't known war. But war was always among competing kingdoms. It was always over power or land, you know what I'm saying? It was over like real things. This was the first time there was a war based on ideologies, right? People were killing each other, harming each other, doing violence to each other because of their belief systems and wanting to impose their belief systems, not just the rule of the king, taking over new territory. So this was the first time, that, again, for Vietnam, that they had this kind of division. And he said, and yet Buddhism was a very ancient tradition within Vietnam, had been there, for over 1,000 years and was very, 80% of the country, were Buddhist. And so he was asked by somebody if he would write articles. So he wrote a series of 10 articles with the title of A Fresh Look at Buddhism. So again, he was young. He also was not happy with traditional Buddhism. I'll talk about that. And so he was given a platform to express sort of the younger generation's view. So he wrote a book, he wrote 10 articles, A Fresh Look at Buddhism. And he said, this is the first time where I began to talk about something he was called engaged Buddhism. And he would talk about, how Buddhism relates to economics, or Buddhism relates to education or politics, right? So this was 54. Obviously, things continued to get worse in Vietnam. He had actually, his story, I won't go into today, but anyhow, he had been out of the country while he was actually in New York, taking courses and teaching at Columbia, at Princeton. But anyhow, he was asked to come back to Vietnam in 64 by the Buddhist movement to get involved, and he did all kinds of wonderful things to try to help his country. But he published a book called Engage Buddhism. And I'm glad we have some Vietnamese speakers in the room. So this is important. Engage Buddhism, which is what we say, is English. Which means it is translated, okay? Now, C-U-O-C-D-O-I. He says, this in Vietnamese means life or society. And D-I-V-A-O means to enter. So what he was writing was, he was talking about a Buddhism that enters life. Okay. Now that was translated as engaged Buddhism, but it has a little different meaning. It's really, and I think the meaning is significant. Because, so what was he talking about? And I think this is very important, because I think in a certain way, we have the opposite problem here in America. So again, it came out of a time and a culture, right? So Buddhism, an ancient tradition in Vietnam, right? 80% of the people believe it. But according to him, he called it, it was temple-based. Which means, you know, and we can understand that as Americans, we might call it church-based, you know. I practice a religion. Oh, what do? I go to church, I go to temple, I go to the mosque, right? I go somewhere to practice. That defines my practice, you see. I go there, I participate in things, but it's there. And so that's what he was seeing. He called that temple Buddhism. It was something that people practiced, do you understand what I'm saying? What he was saying is, no, this is not working anymore. Because he's seeing the whole society unraveling, right? And he's saying, which was not just the war, but also in people's relationships, families. I mean, it was devastating in many ways, the whole social fabric. So what he meant was, Buddhism has to enter the life of Vietnamese society, the world as it is. It can no longer stay in the temples, right? It has to come into the world and engage with the world. Now, when he said the world, he meant, and I'll read, he meant everything. He meant it had to be relevant to the family and family relations, right? It had to be relevant to the social discourse. It had to be relevant to the politics. Of course, it had to be relevant to the war that was going on. And he said, I remember him saying, you know, in the comfort of our monasteries, when the war came to our front door, we could no longer ignore it, right? We had to enter the world. And of course, you know, they entered the world. So I just want to say that, so engage Buddhism in the way he means it, means a Buddhism that has entered life, right? Like, that's what we were doing this morning. In our meditation, in our reflections, right? We were taking Buddhist teachings and Buddhist practicing, and we were allowing them to enter our life, right? To enter our minds, to create the basis for personal transformation and societal transformation. So again, it was in the 80s that the other word, social or socially engaged Buddhism, was added. And I'm not sure if he added it or other people added it, but that was not what he was talking about. So what happened, I think, when he came west is we added, or some, you know, called it socially engaged Buddhism. And because of our, you know, for many people, they have an activist background, all of a sudden engaged Buddhism became synonymous with social activism, right? Which I think is very dangerous. I think engaged Buddhism can include social activism, which means you're active in society. You're active in wanting to change society for the better. Okay, that's That's very much part of engaged Buddhism. But to narrowly define it, as people have done, and turn it into an ideology of socially engaged Buddhism equals social activism, and if you're not socially active, you're not a socially engaged Buddhist, which means you don't practice engaged Buddhism, I think is patently false it's really missing the depth of what Thich Nhat Hanh was proposing. Right. Reflecting on it, it's sort of way we, I remember when I first met him and he was talking to me, he was describing, this was in the mid 70s, and he was telling me about the School of Youth for Social Service and all the things they were doing in Vietnam, you know, and I listened to him and I thought, he doesn't know about social work. It was just very interesting. So what was very radical for his society, where people were actually going out and doing social work, doing community organization, doing community development, right? You see, which was all very new and sort of radical. Here in America, we have a long tradition of what? Of social work, of community development, of community building, people, you see what I'm saying? So there it was very revolutionary because I guess Vietnamese society did not have that tradition, right? We, on the other hand, have that, but we don't have the tradition of what? What they had, which was, we don't have a 1,000-year-old tradition of Buddhist teachings and nonviolence and meditation and learning to live in the present moment. You see, so it's almost like a cross-pollination. And if we're not careful, we can miss that whole piece that we lack and just turn a term like engaged Buddhism, socially engaged Buddhism, as just a sort of saying, you know, all the things that we've already been doing in terms of bettering our society, you know, and our social involvement, social activism, which is part of it, but it misses, I think, the fundamental thing that Thich Nhat Hanh was saying. He's saying we need to take what we have as Buddhists, which is this deep understanding about the nature of life, which is this capacity to be calm and nonviolent and develop a heart of love and understanding and acceptance and learn how to move with that into all the realms of life. Personal life, family life, relationship life, neighbors, work, you know, and into society. So, and here's an early quote. So, it's interesting. He wrote a book. He wrote a book. This first book he wrote in 64, which was his collection of called Engaged Buddhism. There's no published translation of it, which is interesting. I don't know why, but there is a hand typed in Cornell University, some Vietnamese man, and nobody knows who he is. In the 60s. Typed out his translation of that text, and somebody found it in the library. So anyway, I thought that was for those who are interested in detective work, that was interesting. So it's never been published, but maybe it will be. I don't know what's in the pipeline. These original essays, but I would imagine it is available in Vietnam or Vietnamese. So this is a quote from Thich Nhat Hanh. The first meaning of engaged Buddhism is the kind of Buddhism that is present in every moment of our daily life. While you brush your teeth, Buddhism should be there. While you drive your car, Buddhism should be there. While you're walking in the supermarket, Buddhism should be there, so that you know what to buy and what not to buy. Again, this is very important. Because again, perception, filters, we call them filters. As individuals, we have filters. As groups, we have filters, which means, and this is like fundamental Buddhist psychology, what we are experiencing mostly in life is not what's really happening. What we're endlessly experiencing is our ideas, our perceptions about what is happening, right? So as long as, so when, for example, when these teachings come to us from someone or another culture, rather than totally open to really understand it and grapple with it just as it is, and let it kind of challenge or explode our beliefs, what do we do? I mean, and this is really just brain psychology. What does the brain do with it if we're not careful? It distorts it to fill its own filters. You know, it reads it in terms of its own constructs. Is that clear? I mean, that's another Dharma talk, but this is very important. And I think that's what we've done with a lot of these teachings. We have not really heard the message. And I say that personally. I come from a social activist background, coming back to the 60s, you know, and when, you know, I thought Thich Nhat Hanh was, you know, the epitome of a social activist, right? And, you know, a Buddhist social activist, a nonviolent, but he never was. He was an engaged Buddhist. And when his war was being, when his country was being destroyed by war and innocent people were suffering, he became an anti-war activist, right? To respond to that situation, right? When the war was devastating the countryside and the villagers were being, you know, children were being orphaned and nobody was taking care, and you know what I mean? He formed the School of Youth for Social Service, who went out there and rebuilt and did their best to help people. And he started, you know, raising money to support orphans. But he's not a social worker. He's a Zen master who responds to life. Very important. And he says, where does engaged Buddhism begin? It begins when we engage Buddhism, which means not like Buddhism like a thing, but Buddhism like a way of being. You see? So we are mindful as we live our life. But notice that he doesn't say, while you drive your car, Buddhism should be there. When you're in the supermarket, Buddhism should be there, which means, oh, I'm just being mindful of my body and breath, right? Walking up the aisle, I'm fully present to walking up the aisle. Reaching for something, I'm fully present to reaching. You see, many people think, oh, that's being mindful. That's part of being mindful. But that's a mindfulness that has no context. Right? You see, I can be mindful that I'm filling up my cart with only junk food, right? And I can give myself an A plus for mindfulness, right? But I'm not being mindful of what I'm buying and the effects of what I'm buying on my body, on my family's body, you see? So mindfulness has a context. Traditionally, the way mindfulness is translated in Buddhism is, you know, knowing wholesome from unwholesome. I'm mindful of that, right? I am mindful and aware when a wholesome mind state has arisen in me. I'm mindful and aware when an unwholesome mind state has arisen in me. I'm mindful and aware when an action I'm about to take will create harm, and I'm mindful and aware that an action that I'm going to take will create goodness or is wholesome. So that is mindfulness. There has to be that capacity to be present, right? So walking up the aisle and knowing you're walking up the aisle and knowing what you're, as you're reaching, you know, you're present to it. That's the practice. But also, there is this context, right, which is equally as important. And then he goes on to say, also engaged Buddhism is the kind of wisdom that responds to anything that is happening in the here and now. Global warming, climate change, the destruction of the ecosystem, the lack of communication among people and families, war, conflict, suicide, divorce. I mean, you know, the list could go on and on and on. As a mindfulness practitioner, we have to be aware of what is going on in our body, our feelings, our emotions, and our environment. That is engaged Buddhism. Engaged Buddhism is the kind of Buddhism that responds to what is happening in the here and now. Very important. You know, many of us act from ideology, right? We act from beliefs. What's right, what's wrong, how people should be, how people shouldn't be, you know? I mean, many people, you know, in the American Buddhist movement who believe, you know, that, you know, to be an engaged Buddhist means you have to be a social activist. But you know what they also mean? You have to be a certain kind of social activist. You see? You know? Interested. You know, in other religions, there are other people just like that. Right? If you're a good Christian, you are what? You're against this, you're for this, you have a certain political beliefs. Is that true? Yeah, we all know that. Dangerous, isn't it? Dangerous. In Thich Nhat Hanh's first mindfulness training, he said, do not be attached to ideology. Do not be attached to views. He felt in the 20th century, this is the primary problem. Attached to views, attached to ideas. You know, and because of that attachment, we hate, we kill, we do violence, we separate, we divide. Very dangerous for everyone, but, you know, especially for the Buddhist movement. Engaged Buddhism is the kind of Buddhism that is happening in the here and now. I found something very interesting. I'm just a little aside. But at some point, Thich Nhat Hanh, he sort of gave his own kind of historical kind of like the development of religion. It was very short. It was very interesting. So let me see if I can remember it. So in the early days of when society was organized around in a tribal way, right, there were, you know, every tribe had its own god, multiple gods, you know. So he said, you know, so the religion had this multiplicity of gods and forces and spirits and everything when society was very decentralized. Then over time, you know, the concept of a king and a kingdom, one king to rule them all, right? And he said, and along with that came this kind of patriarchal monotheism, right? Same thing, you know, one god to rule them all, right? Who's in charge of everything, right? And then he said, and then I'll quote him. He said, when we come to democracy, there's no king anymore. Everyone is equal to everyone else. So therefore we have to rely on each other to live. Right? He's saying in the past, it's just interesting, he's making this analogy between kind of political, social development and religious development. So it's sort of like, when there's a king, when there's a nobility, the people rely on them. They have all the power, right? But in a democracy, where supposedly we are all equal, this is something different. We have to rely on each other, i.e. democracy only functions if there is a consensual agreement among people that we're all in this together, right? That is why monotheism is changing to a belief in interdependence. And you know, he coined this word interbeing, where there is no longer God. Now, he's not anti-God, so people don't get offended. He means that kind of patriarchal God who rules everything, right? Who we propitiate and thinks has control over everything. He says, we are fully responsible for our life, for our world, for our planet. Let me just read that again. We are fully responsible for our life, for our world, for our planet. I think this says it all, doesn't it? Of what we're dealing with at all levels, with all the multiple issues, right? Right? How do we get all these human beings, right, to take responsibility for themselves, for each other, for the world, for the planet, right? How does it seem to be going so far? Anybody want to make an assessment? So again, I think there's a lot of profundity in the way he says it. This is the great challenge. How do we get people to see that we're all in this together? You know, to see the mutuality, right? The interdependence of everything. You know, everything affects everything else. You know, we can no longer act alone. Right? This is the great challenge of our time. So far, we don't seem to be doing too well, do we? So that is why when you see sort of Thich Nhat Hanh's trajectory post-war, post his involvement in trying to stop the war in Vietnam, his next big involvement was helping the boat people. Many Vietnamese, were in desperate situations in the China Sea and all that, in boats, and you know, they were being preyed upon by pirates. They were not being allowed to. Many countries weren't opening their doors to them. Sort of similar to what we're going through today, in different ways. He became activist, but where he ended up, he was doing sustainable ecological initiatives back in the 60s and 70s. He was writing about these things. And there was a conference he actually was part of, I think in the 70s, Bao Dai. He founded a movement, environmental movement. But anyhow, where did he end up? He ended up sort of as we know him. Right? Because I think he understands, having seen what happened in his own country, and then being in exile in the West for several decades, he understood, unless people changed the way they were, the possibility of human beings to do all we just talked about, to take responsibility for each other and the planet and the world environment, is never going to happen, right? So what did he do? Well, we know what he did. He became a worldwide teacher, writing books, going around the world, giving retreats, giving talks, right, and founding communities, right? He called his communities and the order of interbeing, which I think we've talked about other times. He talked about these are communities of resistance, right? The order of interbeing is an order of resistance. To what? To a, you know, dehumanizing, over-consumed, consumer culture that had lost its way, right? That had lost its way. And so he felt if there weren't these communities, these places to incubate, to show people there's another way to live, to train people in this other way to live. What is this other way to live? Well, I mean, he very much, you know, one of the earliest books that he wrote in the West was called The Future to Be Possible, which was all about ethics, five mindfulness training. You know, we'll talk about that another time. He felt without some kind of common ethical ground in among people, right, that they really live, you know, he's, for a future to be possible, there's really no future if people can't learn how to keep the actions of at least their body and their speech under control and give up all those actions of body and speech that do harm to themselves, to their family members, to each other, right? You know, if people can't do that, then how can groups of people do that, you see? If the individual can't even do that, how can you expect groups of people? Right? So he put great stress on what's called right action, you know, the mindfulness training, 5 and 14, but we won't go into them today. But he stressed that. The other thing we know that he stressed was the practice of mindfulness, right, which I talked about earlier. You know, so what he did was he took, you know, this vastness of Buddhist teaching, which gets profounder and profounder as you go deeper into it, and he pulled out what he felt for this time and age, what is most necessary, right? To kind of prevent society from just continuing to unravel. First thing, some kind of common ethical basis. You know, not Buddhist. That sort of everybody can live by, right? Basically found the principle of doing no harm, doing good, supporting, you know, in the actions of one's body, speech, and mind, supporting things that are wholesome, okay? Secondly, learning, he saw people are so rootless here. People, their minds are so stressed, they're so distracted, they're not present, they're just living in their thoughts. Mindfulness, whew. Right? Mindfulness, learning to be present to one's bodies, present to one's emotions, present to one's feelings, present to one's thought, present to what's going on around one. Right? If one is not present, if one is just living in thoughts or one is totally distracted, how can one ever act, right, in a wholesome way? If we can't even see the situation that's really going on in front of us, if we don't, reaching for the junk food, if we don't know we're reaching for the junk food and know that its effect on us will not be healthy, over here I want to be healthy, over here the hand is reaching for junk food. There's no mindfulness there, can you see? And that's just, I'm just using that as an example, but in our relations, the way we are, with our partners, with our children, with our parents, with our friends, with our colleagues, you know, where's the mindfulness? Right. So the second big piece was mindfulness. And the third was the four measurables, you know, loving kindness, compassion, joy in the joy of others, equanimity. So he kind of pulled out these pieces of a much vaster matrix of Dharma and sort of kind of worked that one, right? as kind of the entryway. How do you take this long tradition with many, 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 many traditions and understanding and create something that is really immediately helpful to all kinds of people? Is that clear? So this is what he's done, right? In his teachings, in his books, in his writing, in the establishment of communities. Because, and this is the importance of community, that there are places like this, and hopefully there'll be there are thousands and thousands, incubators, right? Where, the baby chicks can grow up. Learn how to be mindful, learn how to meditate, learn how to have a clear mind, learn how to be aware of themselves, what's going on. Where are you going to learn that? Do they teach you that at work? Do they teach you that at school? No. So the most important thing that we can do is teach and train people in these ways of being. So therefore they can what? Go out into the world, go out into their lives, go out into their families, go out into society. Do whatever you can to help, you see? Save the planet. But if people don't change the way they are, how could they save a planet when they can't even save themselves from suffering? And again, I think the problem as Americans is we have this very strong doing, social activists, let's get out there and do. And here we are, 2022, how's it going? What's wrong? There's so much doing, so much good ideas, so much good energy, so much, and yet, we have to stop and look deeply. Why is that? What's missing? So, speaking for Thich Nhat Hanh, speaking for myself, what's missing is people really haven't learned another way of being. People haven't really founded communities where they demonstrate that people can live together, all different kinds of people, in all different kinds of ideas and ideologies and races and views, and people can live in harmony with mutual respect, right? People can treat each other decently, lovingly, kindly. People can take care of one another, right? I mean, where are you gonna, it's easy to read the book. It's easy to, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, it's easy to talk the talk. But how many are willing to walk the walk, you see? And to walk the walk, you need another kind of experience, you see. There's got to be another, and that has to be learned. We have to be trained. We have to retrain our minds, retrain our hearts. Right? Sounds so simple, right? To be accepting, to be compassionate to all beings, to want everybody to be happy, right? I mean, it sounds, right? It sounds so easy, so wonderful. And yet if we ask ourselves, how many of us actually live that? How many of us have a mind where that is the state of our mind? I mean, many people have trouble just even accepting themselves as they are. Right? I mean, if you can't accept yourself as you are, I mean, how could you possibly be able to really accept anybody else, right? If you can't be kind to yourself, loving to yourself, compassionate to your own suffering, taking care of it, you see, how can you? Well, I think you get what I mean. So it's a process. Unfortunately, it takes time. You can't take a pill, you can't take a drink, you can't just read the book. It's the problem. I think that's a problem for us Americans because that's the way we kind of do things. Quick, 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 get it done, read the book, tell me what to do. And you can't just, it's not like overnight, that's the problem. So So, you know, Americans, we get frustrated, right? Frustrated. I sit down to meditation and I, what? I don't have the mind I'd like to have. I got this mind that's what? Out of control, full of thoughts, doing all the stuff it does, you know? So people get, you know, they get frustrated. They get angry with themselves. Or they, you know, get down on themselves. Or they just give it up because they don't realize it's a process. It's a process. The larvae, the pupae, doesn't turn into the butterfly directly, does it? It takes time. Chick is in the egg a while. And even when it comes out, it has to be nurtured. Right? So each of us, we have to nurture, you know, that seeds of goodness within us. You know, those seeds of wanting to change, wanting to have a better life, wanting to have a more peaceful mind, wanting to have a more loving heart, wanting to be less judgmental. You know what I'm saying? All that stuff. We have to nurture it. The more we nurture it, the quicker it'll grow. And we have to enter into relationships and communities where the external is also nurturing it, you see. Makes it easier. The egg, you know, the bird doesn't just, you know, lay the egg and just kind of leave it out there, does it? Puts it in the nest. Sits on it. Keeps it warm. And when the chick comes out, the mother and father do what? Just watch them. Watch them in the spring. They're running around, getting little things for them to eat, right? Feeding them. It's quite beautiful. So we are, our desire to awaken, our desire to be free, our desire to be a better human being, to be of greater service to the world, it has to be nurtured carefully. Yeah, so that's what got me going today. I'm always inspired when I return to Thich Nhat Hanh. He is one of the great creative forces within Buddhism, really for not just his own tradition, you know, the Vietnamese Buddhist tradition or the Zen tradition. I mean, he really, you know, he's really been a great creative force, you know, in his, well, let me just say, but we forget he's a Zen master. See, he comes out of an ancient tradition. He comes out of deep meditative practice, if you read his story. You see, so he had that within him. So when he entered the world, to be of help, to be of service, he had great reserves, reservoir within him. So he was able to take on what he's taken on and do what he's done in so many various areas, inspire so many different people in different areas of life. Where does it come from? It comes from his deep practice. Where did he learn his deep practice? From this ancient tradition. Been preserved generation after generation. And you know, we are very fortunate here in America, 2022, that it's available to us. Good fortune. So on that note, Happy New Year. We will continue together. Thank you, everyone.